The world is reacting to yesterday's events at the Capitol. One word from America's strongest ally, disgrace.
It was disgraceful what happened. It shouldn't have happened, given America is such a beacon of democracy around the world.
In Mexico, speculation on how the mob got inside the U.S. Capitol.
What exactly happened and whether there was any help inside the U.S. Capitol Police for this to happen, or what's the deal here?
And a warning from Sri Lanka. Don't think this was just a one-day event.
What happens when you have a coup like this, even if it fails, is it destabilizes your government. And then that opens you up to a whole new level of risk.
I'm Carol Hills. How the globe is reacting to chaos in Washington today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The images are now seared in our memories. Pro-Trump extremists defiling the U.S. Capitol. Still, last night, Congress returned to finish their work and confirmed Joe Biden as the next president. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, who's expected to be the next Senate Majority Leader, put things this way.
President Franklin Roosevelt set aside December 7, 1941, as a day that will live in infamy. Unfortunately, we can now add January 6th, 2021, to that very short list of dates in American history that will live forever in infamy. This temple to democracy was desecrated.
Today, Schumer, along with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, is calling for Trump to be removed from office. Newly elected Congressman Mondaire Jones was in the Capitol building yesterday and joins us now from Washington. Jones is a Democrat who represents New York's 17th district just outside of New York City. Congressman Jones, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been quite an interesting past 24 hours.
Yeah. You were in the House chamber when the Capitol was breached yesterday. I understand security had people kneeling by their seats. Can you tell us what you heard and saw?
Well, I was on the House floor yesterday, and generally in the House chamber, along with 200 other members of Congress and staff persons, when we began to receive alerts on our phones, and then Capitol Police made an announcement that the Capitol had been overtaken and that we would be locking down the House chamber. Once those doors were locked from the inside, eventually I heard a loud banging behind me. That was the mob of dozens of domestic terrorists seeking to break into the House chamber. And so people feared for their lives, myself included. I also feared for our democracy. We were told to look under our seats and withdraw gas masks in the event that tear gas needed to be used, and instructed that we may have to lie down on the floor in the event of gunfire.
And did you hear any gunfire?
I did not hear any gunfire. We eventually were evacuated to another location that was more secure, where we huddled for literally hours with security forces surrounding that room. It was a process that required our being led through tunnels, and you just never knew who was going to be or what was going to be around the corner.
Last night, just before the 6 p.m. curfew in Washington, you tweeted, "I'll just say it, if today's domestic terrorists were black, they would have never been allowed to storm the Capitol." Congressman Jones, you've just been elected as one of the two first openly gay black men to serve in Congress. What do yesterday's events say to you about who gets to protest in the United States?
It said to me what I and most black people in this country already knew, which is that there is a different standard if you are black or brown in this country. You can look at the photos of the level of security used during Black Lives Matter protests for racial justice last summer. It was so heightened relative to yesterday. And of course, we had ample notice about the crowd sizes and the motivations and ideologies of the people who were going to descend upon Washington, D.C. to try to disrupt our democracy. And yet, clearly there were insufficient resources to protect us from the mob that overtook the Capitol. So there needs to be great accountability from a security standpoint.
We associate terrorism with acts done by people or groups from other nations. What are the legal implications of using the label domestic terrorists?
The legal implications are the same as the dictionary implications. We have to call domestic terrorism what it is, and that is precisely what these people were yesterday. They were domestic terrorists seeking to overthrow the United States government. It can't be that you have to be a brown person, that you have to be Muslim in America in order for that word to apply to you. That's not fair. And it does a disservice when it comes to making sure that white domestic terrorism, like what we saw yesterday, is addressed in this country from a security and law enforcement standpoint.
Late last night, you called for a full investigation of the security breaches and, along with some of your colleagues in Congress, the impeachment of President Trump. Why are you calling for his impeachment and the invocation of the 25th Amendment?
I'm calling for Donald Trump's impeachment because I have a constitutional responsibility to be a check on the executive branch of government. And so that means impeachment must occur when it is appropriate, as it is today in the wake of criminal behavior, in the incitement of violence against the legislative branch of the United States government, with co-conspirators in the House and Senate who have been participating in this through propagating this myth of voter fraud, this myth that the government is trying to oppress people, this myth that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. That rhetoric has consequences, and we also need an investigation with respect to any coordination that occurred between these members and the people who descended upon the Capitol yesterday. I'm also calling, as you noted, for invocation of the 25th Amendment. It's why I signed onto a letter to Mike Pence yesterday calling on him and Trump cabinet officials to invoke that. We need to remove this president. He's shown himself to be a danger even in the final weeks of his presidency.
After everything that happened inside the House chamber yesterday, you and your colleagues returned to certify the Electoral College votes. You carried out what some people yesterday were trying to stop. What does it mean that Congress went back to work last night and ratified the election results? I mean, what message does that send to the rest of the world?
The message that was sent at the end of the day to the rest of the world is that the United States of America is still a place where democracy can and must exist. And I'm so proud of House Democrats for surviving yesterday's antics and indeed a violent insurrection in order to come together to certify the November election. We don't have to live like this. We can model good behavior and we can save this democracy and even strengthen it. But we need new leadership.
Congressman Jones, how secure do you feel back in the Capitol today?
I feel as though we need to do an investigation of the security breaches that occurred yesterday and ensure that we have people securing the Capitol and members of Congress who do not share the ideologies of the people who were able to overtake the House. And that will make me feel more secure.
Democratic Congressman Mondaire Jones represents New York's 17th District. He's been speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Congressman, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Now let's get some reaction to what's happening in Washington from around the globe and what's happened to America's international image as a model for democracy. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
American democracy had a very bad day yesterday, as images of rioters ransacking Capitol Hill shot across the globe, foreign leaders were quick to comment.
Und mich haben diese Bilder wütend und auch traurig gemacht.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the images out of D.C. made her furious and sad. Most friends of the United States, she said, admired America's democratic tradition. On Twitter, Merkel wrote that her own departure from the office would be quite boring. In France, President Emmanuel Macron offered a heartfelt defense of the American political system. He even did it in English.
We believe in the strength of our democracies. We believe in the strength of American democracy.
Reaction came from all corners of the globe. There was some trolling, for sure, from Turkey, Venezuela, and China. But many leaders spoke up. And the common thread in their messages, as one European diplomat put it, American democracy was under siege. Zakaria Mumpli teaches at City University in New York. Mumpli has researched and written books about uprisings in Africa.
I think one of the key issues right now is the potentially death of the narrative of American exceptionalism, the idea that the U.S. is a uniquely democratic country that would not be prone to the types of actions that we witnessed yesterday.
He says for a long time, the U.S. relied on that narrative to promote democracy abroad. But during his time working and researching in African countries, he heard a lot of skepticism about that.
Many African countries have experienced American interventionism that has long not adhered to the rhetoric of democracy that the U.S. government often deploys. So I think there's a sense of comeuppance right now in many parts of the world.
In the city of Ramallah in the Palestinian territories, Salem Barahmeh was watching the riots play out in Washington. He runs an NGO called the Palestinian Institute for Public Diplomacy. His reaction?
It was a mix of amazement and horror.
He says the first thing that stood out to him was how different the police responded compared to what it seemed back in the summer with the Black Lives Matter protests.
You know, if those protesters were not white, they would have been arrested, beaten, hurt.
And Barahmeh says he could relate.
One thing that struck me was the parallel I felt in my own life as a Palestinian in Palestine, living under a system of segregation, and also one where your freedom and rights are determined by your ethno-national identity.
The images of policemen taking selfies with rioters were disturbing to Sandeep Roy. He's a writer based in Kolkata, India. Roy says he too watched in disbelief as the windows of the Capitol building were shattered and offices of lawmakers trashed.
I was shocked and I was also deeply saddened.
At the same time, he says maybe the events of yesterday should not have been all that surprising.
What has happened is that a certain kind of bigotry and hatred and violence has been mainstreamed and normalized. This was always part of the body politic in America, but it was just not allowed to become mainstream.
President Trump has considerable support in India, and Roy says some of his fans have been silent, but others have applauded the actions of the rioters in Washington. India, he says, has had its own share of discontent on issues such as farmers' rights and citizenship for Muslims.
Ironically, the same people are quite aghast and shocked when farmers or protesters about a citizenship bill change or Muslims come to the Indian capital or do a kind of a hunger strike or something blocking roads to press their demands.
Roy says he has the feeling American democracy will make it through this troubling time. But he says it's high time for the country to examine its self-appointed role as the policeman of the world. Salem Barahmeh in the Palestinian territories makes a similar point. He says democracy can come under threat, even in the U.S.
I think it also will require the U.S. to take a very deep look at its institutions and the framework of its society and be humble about it and not always think it's in a position to preach to the rest of the world about democracy.
And as always, people across the globe will be watching. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Later on the program, the letter Q was seen a lot at the Capitol yesterday. We'll tell you what that's all about ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. People across the globe are reacting to the events in Washington yesterday when a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol. For some outside perspectives, we turn to three countries with some pretty different ties to the U.S., the U.K., Russia, and Kenya. We're joined by The World's reporters Halima Gikandi in Nairobi, Orla Berry in London, and Daniel Offman in New York, who's looking at the response in Russia. First, a question for all of you. How are you seeing people react to what happened in Washington yesterday? Orla, I want to start with you and what you're seeing in the UK.
What many are saying is that while they're stunned at what unfolded in the Capitol building yesterday, I think people are saying that they're not completely surprised, because for many people here, it's almost a confirmation of where America seemed to be headed for the last 4 years. You know, there's a lot of talk today about how something appears to be broken in America, and Donald Trump leaving the White House won't fix that. If you look at the headlines on the British newspapers this morning, three separate British newspapers ran with the same headline, Anarchy in the USA. The Financial Times, which is quite a sober, business-oriented newspaper, their editor tweeted about an attempted coup in America yesterday. But I wanted to play you, Carl, the opening moments of the Today programme this morning. This is the BBC's most listened to morning radio show.
The mob had come to the capital to overturn a vote their hero, their champion, had told them was fraudulent. And revolt they did, marching up the steps of the capital, striding through its corridors, occupying its offices, as if they were retaking the abandoned palace of a hated dictator.
And that, by the way, is a programme that is not one for exaggeration or over-dramatisation normally in any way, Carl.
Wow. Daniel, what about in Russia?
We haven't heard directly from the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, but Maria Zakharova, who's the spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry, did put out a statement today which said in part, quote, "The events in Washington show that the U.S. electoral process is archaic, does not meet modern standards, and is prone to violations." So from the Kremlin's perspective, there's value kind of in emphasizing moments of disarray in the U.S. And adding to that message, the Russian state media is usually prone to kind of exaggerate and play up division in the U.S. And in this case, the truth, kind of the reality of what's going on in America, that's the most effective propaganda. And by the way, today is Christmas in the Eastern Orthodox world. So imagine these two images on your TV screen. The U.S. in chaos, rioters storming into the Capitol building on one hand, and at home, President Putin is visiting churches and celebrating Christmas peacefully. That's a powerful contrast of two images.
Halima, what are you seeing in Kenya?
This was something that any Kenyan who was had turned on the news last night, this is what they were seeing. And there was one reaction I heard from a minister of parliament today. He was speaking to a local news channel. His name's Paul Otiende Amolo, and this is what he had to say.
It is despicable. It is unfortunate that the president who swears to uphold the constitution should encourage a riotous mob.
That said, he also said that what he learned was that the U.S., like any other democracy, will face challenges, and democracy is a work in progress everywhere.
Orla, going back to the U.K., Boris Johnson, of course, has an historically quite close relationship with President Trump. Has that changed in the last 24 hours?
Yes, it's been very interesting to watch, Carl, because as you say, up until a very short time ago, Boris Johnson and his cabinet have been very careful not to be critical of Donald Trump. First of all, when the protesters burst into the Capitol building yesterday afternoon, Boris Johnson did tweet at the time and say, "Disgraceful scenes in the US Congress. The United States stands for democracy around the world, and it's now vital there should be a peaceful and orderly transfer of power." But a lot of people commented and said, well, you know, who's responsible for that? You haven't name-checked the president in any of this. But just before talking to you, Boris Johnson was giving a press conference on the vaccination and COVID, etc. here, and he was asked about it and his reaction today to what's been happening in Washington.
He encouraged people to storm the Capitol, and insofar as the president consistently has cast doubt on the outcome of a free and fair election, I believe that that was completely wrong. I think what President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
And this is the first time, Carl, that the Prime Minister has name-checked Trump in relation to any of this. So it certainly is an about-face by him.
Hmm. Daniel, you touched on this before, but Russia is usually quick to jump on American weakness and amplify that. I'm curious how you've been seeing that play out.
So as I said, this story is being used for kind of propaganda purposes in Russia. But on the other hand, last night on the Senate floor, Russia and other former Soviet countries were brought up multiple times.
There's nothing Vladimir Putin could have come up with better than what happened here. Makes us look like we're in total chaos and collapse.
That's Senator Marco Rubio speaking there, and Senator Mitt Romney also brought up Russia in his speech. The bottom line is that moments of instability in the U.S. do help Russia undermine the West and point out its flaws because it's right out there in the open. Here's another example. The Speaker of the Russian Parliament, Vyacheslav Volodin, said that America should not be looked at as a symbol of democracy, that America shouldn't be exporting its ideals because of moments like this. There's a battle of ideas here. And when shameful events like this happen in America, adversaries like Russia will always try to push their narrative.
Halima, in Africa, there have been many elections recently, Central African Republic, Ghana, next week, Uganda. The U.S. often weighs in about elections there and their stability and validity. How does last night look in that context?
Definitely a great question. I mean, historically, the U.S. has invested a lot of resources in supporting democracy and helping to strengthen democracy here in Kenya, as well as in other countries in the continent. And when elections happen, we journalists, we look to what statements the U.S. will say about either calling for free elections or condemning and calling for leaders to peacefully transfer power. So with the events of last night, there's this open question about, can the U.S. really be a credible voice here in elections, here or anywhere else? In fact, on the opposite side of the continent, in Zimbabwe, President Edward Mnangagwa tweeted that what happened yesterday shows the U.S. has, quote, no moral right to punish another nation under the guise of upholding democracy. Even ordinary people have had similar reactions. I spoke with Agria Doji. He's a Kenyan motorcyclist here in Nairobi, and he was watching the news on CNN last night. And he was just saying that the events in the U.S. do matter to Kenyans because Kenya has its own presidential election next year. And in the past, the U.S. has helped mediate election disputes here, especially elections that have turned violent. So the question is, when the U.S. democracy itself is undermined, who will support and be a strong voice for those fighting for democracy over here?
Lots to think about. Halima Gikandi, Orla Barry, and Daniel Offman, thanks a lot for your insights.
Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome, Carl.
Thanks, Carol.
Our focus, just like you, has been on the situation in D.C. and the transfer of power in the U.S. You rely on the world on the radio and through our podcast. Here's one more way we can connect each morning. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World. It's on our website at theworld.org/newsletters. Chinese state officials are watching closely, and they're drawing their own parallels between Washington, D.C. and Hong Kong.
Mike Pompeo condemned the protests at the Capitol as intolerable. But is the violence and protests last year in Hong Kong acceptable to him?
That's still ahead this hour on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. If you watched footage of yesterday's siege at the U.S. Capitol, you may have spotted people wearing shirts or holding banners with the letter Q. That Q stands for QAnon. It's a conspiracy theory that in recent years has creeped up from the fringes of the internet into the mainstream. Supporters of QAnon were among those who stormed the Capitol yesterday. The World's Lydia Amanalidou reports on what it is and how it's grown internationally.
Researcher Anna Sophie Harling in London was glued to her screen yesterday as events on Capitol Hill unfolded. Her feelings?
Shocked and horrified, but I would say surprised not at all.
Harling works for NewsGuard, a startup that tracks and fights misinformation. She wasn't caught off guard by what happened yesterday. Other researchers who study misinformation, extremism, conspiracy theories saw it coming too.
Over the last couple of months and weeks, we've seen a lot of chatter across different social media platforms and networks around January 6th being the day that the storm is coming and there will be some great kind of riot or protest happening in D.C.
A lot of this chatter was coming from QAnon, an online community of conspiracy theorists. QAnon started on the anonymous messaging board 8chan back in 2016 by a person who called themselves Q.
And claimed that they were working with White House insiders to help President Trump take down a ring of Satan-worshipping child sex traffickers that included members of the Democratic Party and prominent celebrities.
When QAnon believers took their fringe ideas to more popular social media platforms, algorithms that favor sensational content helped them grow.
The algorithms really make it easy to find more and more extreme types of content, whether you're on YouTube or Facebook. So when you join one QAnon group, it was the case a year ago that Facebook would suggest five more to you.
As the group grew in numbers, so did the dangerous beliefs and outlandish conspiracy theories its followers embraced.
JFK was definitely murdered by CIA. 9/11 was an inside job. People in our government are working towards a deep state who are trying to keep us controlled.
This is a QAnon believer, Nick Natoli, speaking with this BBC Newsnight reporter.
Children are being harvested. Children are being farmed by celebrities and politicians.
Not outlandish at all.
Today, the group is also known for peddling anti-Semitic tropes, COVID-19 misinformation, anti-vaccine beliefs. In this mishmash of delusions, QAnon followers are ultimately united by this one thing, their love for Trump. They see him as their ultimate savior, the only one capable of fighting against society's ills. This idea has resonated beyond the U.S., Researcher Anna Sophie Harling says QAnon grew popular in the UK, France, Germany, Italy, and Australia.
I think what makes QAnon so internationally appealing is it offers a view of the world where they say it doesn't matter who you are or where you live, Donald Trump can save you, and he is the one true leader. He's better than your own prime minister or president.
All over the world, QAnon Facebook groups, YouTube channels, Twitter accounts reached millions. And late last year, these big platforms decided to ban them amid a crackdown on conspiracy theories. But by then, researchers say, it was too late. QAnon supporters found ways to regroup, either on the same sites more discreetly or on other more obscure platforms like Gab and Parler. And they used some of these platforms to organize against the election results, which they rejected.
January 6th, Q supporters really felt that that was going to be the big day of reckoning. And we're telling everyone to hang tight and trust in the plan and believe that Trump was going to find a way.
Harling says she hopes yesterday is proof that online chatter, fringe, and seemingly outlandish ideas on the internet can have devastating real-world consequences. She says these groups and these ideas are still out there, and that it's going to take a lot more effort from social media companies, from politicians, from individual people to stop them. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called yesterday's siege of the U.S. Capitol building a disgrace. In a tweet, Johnson said the United States stood for democracy around the world and that a peaceful and orderly transfer of power in the U.S. was vital. Johnson has been reluctant to criticize Trump in the past. We reached out to the U.K.'s ambassador to the U.S., Karen Pierce. She had some harsh words for the U.S. president.
I don't think any political leaders, including President Trump, should ever take the risk that their comments might lead to violence or to the mob taking control. And we saw a number of comments yesterday from the president, from Rudy Giuliani. We saw a number of comments even from a few people in Congress themselves saying, oh, well, you know, the election was stolen. I think I would want to point to all the court decisions saying that there was no evidence at all of electoral fraud. And I think that's a very important point. The American institutions themselves have the necessary checks and balances and principles to be able to put American democracy back on track.
But it still is quite dramatic that this mob basically takes over the legislative branch of the government, literally. Who do you feel is responsible, if not the president, for encouraging this group?
The people in the mob themselves, to be absolutely honest. You don't have to storm the Capitol. You don't have to disrupt the legislative process, even if blame is shared for incitement elsewhere. It was disgraceful what happened. It shouldn't have happened. It's a real pity as a friend of America to see it happen here, given America is such a beacon of democracy around the world. But in the end, Congress got things back on track. And I do think that's an important point.
The U.S. likes to describe itself as a guardian of democracy. What do yesterday's events tell you about the reliability of the U.S. as a diplomatic partner and a voice for democratic rule?
I think it will be only natural that there's a lot of schadenfreude and probably a lot worse in places like Russia and China. But in the end, Congress was able to complete its certification of the election, and the US does remain a beacon of democracy around the world. And, you know, people are not queuing up to get asylum in places like Russia and China. What you see in China with Hong Kong, for example, is a very different set of circumstances, because the involved the Chinese going back on commitments they've made. It involves denying the right to protest and the right to free speech and the right to be an opposition politician. So from my perspective, the US long-term reputation is not under threat, though I think we have to admit yesterday was not a great look.
You're being very diplomatic, but I want to mention to you what your predecessor, Kim Derrick, said. He said, "The scenes last night were appalling and difficult to imagine in America. Some of us, though, have been pointing out for a long time, this guy was not fit to be president, and he doesn't respect any of the norms of presidential behavior." What happened last night, many feel, was the result of the sitting president's days of inciting his supporters to turn up in Washington. Doesn't that change the calculation on how you think of a person or deal with them?
Diplomats are diplomats. Private citizens like Kim are private citizens. But we don't have high-level engagement going on with the White House at the moment because we're coming to the end of the administration. But we do have exchanges with the White House. But as the Prime Minister said, we do agree with those people who thought that the scenes yesterday were disgraceful. But fundamentally, as friends of the United States, we have enormous confidence in America's capacity for renewal and America's adherence, long-term adherence, to democratic norms. And I think you saw that in what Congress was able to do last night.
British diplomat Karen Pierce is the UK's ambassador to the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the many questions being asked after yesterday's violence at the Capitol is this: why wasn't there a stronger display of law enforcement, especially compared with the shows of force against Black Lives Matter protesters earlier this year? As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, some experts say race cannot be overlooked and that white supremacy and privilege were a factor.
As founder of the group DC Concerned Citizens, Ty Hobson Powell has been part of a lot of protests around the Capitol.
There were instances where we were met with tear gas, we were met with rubber bullets, police pushing us back with their bikes, with their hands, all just for trying to peacefully assemble in the streets.
So, like many people, he had an immediate thought yesterday while watching mobs encroach on the Capitol, that law enforcement would have been ready for the onslaught if they looked like his group, predominantly Black and brown people. Instead, for hours, the mostly white crowds loitered. Well-known right-wing racists were among those who occupied the Capitol. A few wore shirts with neo-Nazi graphics and slogans.
We've seen law enforcement that were on site holding hands of supporters and helping them down the steps.
Hobson Powell heard mainstream media describe the people there as protesters. It was something he's seen many times before, a phenomenon he says compounds the experience of racism, the reluctance to call out white supremacy and white privilege.
And so when we think about an armed takeover of the Capitol building, we have to acknowledge that a big source of that is kind of white identity politics and white grievance.
Carrie Lee is an assistant professor at the U.S. Air War College in Alabama, speaking here in a personal capacity. She says law enforcement tends to see white crowds as less threatening.
That is a function of how we interpret different faces in this country. You can have a sea of minorities and the police feel more threatened and therefore use more force, as opposed to a sea of white faces, you know, who get the benefit of the doubt.
That attitude in part left the Capitol exposed, despite the fact that after 9/11, the U.S. government poured billions of dollars into making federal buildings more secure, and despite signs of more extremism. Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, has been warning about increasing domestic terrorism.
There were many of us who were raising concerns about this over the last several years.
He says the situation at the Capitol isn't unique. German says many law enforcement officers across the country sympathize with some views of far-right groups.
Even though if you look around the country and you look at the most violent acts, it's far-right militants that are engaging in them. But law enforcement is allowing them often to come into their communities, commit this violence, and walk away without any penalty. So that has encouraged them to believe that they are authorized to engage in this behavior.
Another factor? Historically, the U.S. has treated domestic threats very differently from those from abroad. Bruce Hoffman's a senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says that for international terrorism threats, certain consequences kick in, like legal and financial sanctions when a group is designated a terrorist organization.
No such
legislation exists in the United States to designate and to sanction domestic terrorist groups. So, of course, there's a complete difference in the way foreign threats are handled from domestic ones, because the domestic ones repeatedly bump up against concerns over violating First Amendment and freedom of assembly rights.
But Ty Hobson-Powell says these domestic threats will only grow if police officers are allowed to be complicit with impunity, which he says was on full display yesterday at the Capitol.
People are not being honest with themselves about the fact that this is very American. This kind of terror has been inflicted on Americans in many different ways. Until we can be honest about what America has been, America will never become what it can be.
Meanwhile, heading toward Inauguration Day, Hobson-Powell, like many Americans, is expecting more protests. But he won't have the usual front seat view as a D.C. resident. He'll be in court for an arrest he got at a Black Lives Matter protest. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Washington.
The sight of a mob breaking into the Capitol building is tough to explain. Now imagine interpreting yesterday's events for people in another country. Jose Diaz-Briseño reports from Washington, D.C. for Reforma, a newspaper in Mexico City. Jose, how did you report this to people in Mexico yesterday?
This is an unprecedented development happening in Washington, D.C. During my past 15 years as a correspondent in Washington, I've never seen something like this. This event took place at the instance of President Trump itself. So it's a little bit surprising and weird coming from Latin America to see the president of a country itself inciting violence.
You mentioned the shock at seeing Congress itself, the actual building, being basically invaded and taken over by this mob. I'm curious, in Mexico City, how protected is your legislative counterpart? I mean, how hard would it be for a group of people to break in and bust in?
It's extremely protected. We haven't had such a situation, I guess, in decades. That's the reason why it's surprising. As a reporter covering Washington for 15 years, we just are dumbfounded about the fact that we go through so many layers of security to go into the Capitol at some point. And yesterday, the basic measures of crowd control were not there. So there are many people speculating about what exactly happened and whether there was any help inside the U.S. Capitol Police for this to happen.
Oh, so there's speculation about whether Capitol Police itself helped the protesters and insurrectionists.
That's what Mexican readers and people in social media in Mexico are saying, because they cannot explain why so much violence from the police is taken when riots happen in other parts of the country. But when the seat of power in the U.S. is really at stake, nothing happens. And that has confounded many Mexican commentators. And they openly say, well, is there some problem within the Capitol Police for this to happen? Or what's the deal here?
In that video that President Trump posted yesterday, he urged calm, but then he signaled support for the rioters, saying, we love you, you're very special. How do you explain that apparent contradiction to readers in Mexico?
You have to go directly to the facts themselves rather than think about your personal opinions, obviously. And the fact here is that the rioters interrupted the democratic process in the counting and the certification of the votes from the states at Congress. And the fact that the president didn't address that in his video is something that should be taken with alarm. And that's exactly what I focus my reporting on, that President Trump was in some ways not condemning violence openly in a way that actually stopped the certification of the votes in Congress.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has been close to President Trump, and yesterday he refused to comment on the crisis at the Capitol. How do you interpret that, given the importance to Mexico of the transition of power in the U.S.?
The fact that President López Obrador didn't condemn any act of violence against the seat of the legislative power in the U.S. is surprising. He himself says he's a champion of democracy, but he basically used the pretext of the principle of non-intervention for not saying anything surrounding the U.S. events. Many people say, observers in Mexico, political scientists, that he's basically taking a position so that the incoming Biden administration doesn't criticize his own policies in areas like energy, human rights, and others. He doesn't want any foreign interference in his own national project.
We still have 2 weeks left of the Trump presidency. How interested are Mexicans in the drama of this presidential transition?
These are going to be very tough 2 weeks because President Trump is in many ways a volatile presence in the White House. And we in Mexico are considering this period as a very sensitive one. Mexico has a lot of connections to the U.S. in terms of trade, the border, and the Mexican economy is closely aligned to the U.S. one. So any development here is taken with a lot of seriousness.
Jose Diaz-Pruzeno is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for Mexico City's Reforma newspaper. Thanks a lot, Jose.
Thank you so much.
Yesterday's events in Washington shocked the world. Our China correspondent, Rebecca Canther, is in Shanghai and was watching from there. Rebecca, what was the reaction in China?
Well, people were paying close attention to this. Videos and memes were being shared over Chinese social media. Television was covering the event. So that's Chinese state-run television showing footage in the middle of its evening news broadcast. They showed footage of protests not only in D.C., but also in L.A. and other states. I think the point that they're trying to make, it fits into their narrative of, you know, a chaotic American democracy and a stable Chinese government.
What has the Chinese government said about what happened in Washington?
Well, at the foreign ministry press conference today, the spokesperson Hua Chunying, she took a very smug response. She says, "I read that Mike Pompeo condemned the protests at the Capitol as intolerable. But is the violence and protests last year in Hong Kong acceptable to him? He says he wants to save Hong Kong. I ask him to open his eyes and take a look at the people of China and Hong Kong. Our lives are very good. The people who need saving are the American people."
So she's kind of making a big jab at the U.S., isn't she?
Yes, she went on. there was more where that came from. And people were commenting on the videos of her statement and saying, "Good job, you were well spoken." Then I spoke with Wei Zongyo. He's a professor of U.S.-China relations at Fudan University in Shanghai. And he said that it was a huge surprise to see this level of chaos in the U.S.
What's happening in the United States gives a big blow to U.S. image and also a blow to the democracy.
So he says this strengthens support for China's political system. I think he was trying to explain that, of course, people in China know that the system in China is not perfect and hope it can improve, but that the stability thing is important to them.
So what's been the overall narrative on Chinese social media sites about what happened?
Most people are posting memes and photos calling the U.S. out for a double standard. They are posting photos of what's going on in D.C. and saying it's a beautiful sight, which is referencing what Nancy Pelosi described the Hong Kong protests of last year as.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Thank you.
American democracy prides itself on the peaceful transfer of power. What we're seeing right now is anything but. For one writer in Sri Lanka, what's unfolding in Washington looks familiar. 2 years ago, Sri Lanka had its own experience with a political leader refusing to leave office. And not long after, violence erupted. Sri Lankan writer and podcaster Indy Samarajiva is a close observer of American government. His prescient essay in November was called "I Lived Through a Stupid Coup. America is Having One Now." Indy, what were your first thoughts when you saw what was happening in Washington yesterday?
So when I heard about it this morning, I thought it was crazy, but also I think you could very clearly see this coming. I could see this coming. I think this was really telegraphed quite far in advance.
You live in Sri Lanka. There was an attempted coup in 2018. Do you see these two events, what happened in Washington and what happened in Sri Lanka, in similar terms?
I can show you two photographs, which are exactly the same photograph in two different situations. We had someone occupy the speaker's chair in Parliament. You've had someone occupy the speaker's chair in your Congress. It's basically the exact same picture, except your guys are more heavily armed. Our guys were just throwing chili powder.
You're talking about the images yesterday of when the mob basically moved into the Capitol and were kind of hanging out and sitting in chairs and things like that.
Exactly. So we had the exact same images, except those were our opposition MPs. Those guys were at least elected to be in Parliament. So we elected our mob. You guys have a completely unruly white supremacist gun-wielding mob, and that's much scarier. And of course, four people have died.
The article you wrote just 2 months ago, you sort of make the point that the U.S. doesn't even understand what's going on with these kind of protests, and that was before yesterday's events. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's a sense of American exceptionalism. So there's a sense that these things can't happen to you. Whereas all over the rest of the world, we're kind of used to this. So you guys have been inflicting all of this trauma on the world. And now chickens have, to a large degree, come home to roost. Look, when terrorists attacked on 9/11, when they attacked the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and I think the other target was either Congress or the White House, those are symbolic attacks on your centers of power. This is a symbolic attack on your center of power. So they have attacked, they have breached your Congress. So you're under attack. And if you keep saying, we just have to hold out for 14 days until the inauguration, or we just have to wait for this, or it'll all go back to normal, I think you're not understanding where you are.
What has happened in Sri Lanka in the 2 years since in terms of what might be in store for Americans after what happened yesterday that we're not even thinking might happen? What has been torn asunder, do you think?
Even if a coup fails, it still damages your government. So what happened to us was the coup happened and the courts rolled it back. So we had the elected government back, and that seemed good. But that government was crippled. And then that government couldn't respond to a terrorist threat, which is, you know, 3 months down the line. And then all hell broke loose. And then it was completely unstable. And then the people who staged the coup were able to point to the chaos that they helped create and say, hey, you need us in. And so that's who's been elected. I think perhaps what Americans may not be understanding is that it's not over. When you attack your center of government, when you attack Congress, even symbolically, that weakens your governance. And when governance is weakened, it's like a Pandora's box. All sorts of other risks come out of there.
You mentioned earlier that the U.S. foreign policy has caused a lot of rancor around the globe and it's coming home to roost. What do you mean by that?
I don't mean that the rancor is coming home to roost. I mean that sort of the militarization of your society, the violence of your society. So a lot of the people who would have attacked your Congress, they might have been, you know, serving in Afghanistan or Iraq, causing God knows what problems to the people there. The militarization has come to your borders. Your militarization at the edges of your society has come home to roost. And the violence of your culture, which has always been projected outwards, is now falling in.
Are there any other valid comparisons to make between the U.S. and Sri Lanka in terms of, I'm thinking of your article and this sense of something's happened here and we didn't really understand what. And in the U.S., maybe Americans not understanding what's really happened at some basic level, trying to think that this will all right itself.
Look, I think the most valid comparison to make is that we are comparable. As in, you can learn something from someone in Sri Lanka, you can learn something from someone in Lagos, in Dhaka. So people have been through similar experiences. And this is an exercise I think Americans don't do enough. Because as long as you think you're exceptional, as long as you think like things can't happen to you, then you'll be constantly surprised. And you won't learn from other human experiences. If you can just let go of this thing that we're America, this can't happen to us, this isn't happening to us. And you can see that it is happening to you, and then you can start to learn from the world, then perhaps you can join us.
Indy Samarajiva is a writer in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Take care, Carol.
And that is where we're going to leave things today. But we're always online at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills, and we are going to do it all over again tomorrow.